Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Scumbags, this is the Scummy Mummies podcast with your hosts Ellie Gibson and Helen Thorne.
Hello and welcome to the Scummy Mummies podcast. It's me, Helen Thorne.
And it's me, Ellie Gibson.
Ellie, I am thrilled today because we have the wonderful, the brilliant Julia Samuel. Hello, Julia.
Hello, Ellie and Helen, lovely to be here on your podcast.
Oh my god, that's more polite than we usually get, Helen. That's very nice.
It's very nice. She set the tone.
Yes,
we'll be lovely. Very, very, very polite now. No swearing, Ellie. Go on.
Oh yeah, good luck with that. I'm going to give you about 8 minutes.
I'm actually known for swearing.
So. Oh, are you?
Yes.
Come into the bosom of the Scummy Mummy, Julie. Well, we're very excited because we're at your... Is this your house? And is this one of your rooms that you do your...
So this is my psychotherapy room, yeah.
If these walls could talk,
oh
Helen.
My God.
The things you must have heard in here, Julia.
Oh. I've heard mainly a great deal of sadness.
Yeah,
but also, everything. Mm.
Lots of tears. Do you ever cry?
Yes, I do.
Do you?
With my clients, yeah.
Oh.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
The way you said that wasn't very convincing.
Did it not sound very sincere?
Oh,
not
very good.
That sounded like, oh.
Let me try again.
Go on, Ellie.
Try again. No. Is that better?
No. That was patronising.
I was patronising, yeah.
Oh, God.
That's
drama.
Yeah. Okay.
None of it worked.
Just forget I've said anything. Okay. Let's carry on. Go, Helen, go.
And how long have you been practising as a psychotherapist?
About 32 years. So
wow.
Probably longer than you've lived.
Yes, exactly. Well, I am 29
just,
on Tinder.
Just about, yeah.
So that's correct, Julia. Wow.
So what sort of psychotherapy do you specialise in, or what area do you specialise in?
So my specialty is grief. I worked just across the road at St Mary's Paddington supporting families who had children and babies die. Mm. And I helped start a charity, find a patron called Child Bereavement UK. So I did that. I was at Mary's 25 years. But I now... see clients. That is the heart of what I do, is a therapist.
Yeah.
And I write. And come on your amazing podcast.
Yes, well, this is obviously what you've been building up to.
Yes.
All your career.
This is like the Oscars.
Yes, it is.
In therapy terms.
This is your victory walk. This is your victory yes. lap after all the hard work. Gosh, I mean, child bereavement, you know, that's...
I mean, where do you even... start with that, because obviously many of us think that's the worst thing that could possibly happen. So when someone comes into the room and meets you kind of for the first time and says they've lost a child, where do you even begin?
I mean, I can feel it now still, just as you say that, in my chest and in my stomach. It is, well, in my understanding of the world, I think it is the worst thing that can happen to you. And I think the kind of key thing that I do is I acknowledge when they first come how devastating it is and how much pain they're in, and I can't fix that because their child has died and nothing can fix that.
Mm.
And I hope to kind of build a relationship where they feel safe with me, where they allow themselves to feel the sort of full panoply of what they feel, which society and often their family or the outside world doesn't allow, because suffering is complex and noisy and messy and complicated and brings up versions of ourselves that we didn't even know we had. Like being a mother brings up a different version of you. Being a grieving mother brings up a different version of you. And so I hope that they, in kind of fully expressing and kind of learning to accommodate and find a way of living, and in the end, I hope, loving again following the death of their child. Because at the moment of the death, even, I don't mean even as if it's worse or better, but even when they have other children, is the death of everything they believed in, trusted, and expected for the future. It's a death of what they saw. You know, that it's a death out of time. You would never imagine that you would bury your own child.
Mm.
That was probably a longer, more complicated answer than you expected.
No, but an excellent one. Is it true that we all experience different grief in different ways, and it manifests in different ways, or are there common threads and common sort of experiences and ways of coping that you see through people?
I mean, that's a really good question. So I think in some ways we're as different on the inside as we look on the outside, and yet we have common features, eyes and nose and mouth. And so the common features are the level of the pain is equal to the level of the loss. So, and pain is the agent of change, and pain is the kind of biggest, shoutiest aspect of grief. And that can come in many forms of feeling furious, raging, despairing, sad, jealous, you know, all the different kind of feelings. But what is also universal is that we need to find a way of expressing and experiencing our grief, allowing pain to be the agent of change, because that is how we heal. And the things that we do to block the pain, which could be business, it could be anesthetics like sex or drink or alcohol or whatever, those keep the pain kind of tight inside us, but then it comes up and gets us unchanged, unresolved through the rest of our life.
Sounds brilliant. Grief's just great, isn't it? Sounds bright laugh.
Absolutely wonderful.
Have you ever had a significant loss?
Well, do you know, that was sort of going to be my next question, because no, to be honest, not really. Yes, touching all the wood, but I've lost grandparents. Yeah. But again, that's not out of time, right? That's, we all expect that. So one of my grandmothers was 100, so it was not a great shock. That was fine. But you know, I had a sort of glimpse of it because my son was born 9 weeks early, so that was touch and go. So I remember I described it to someone at the time. I had a little look into the abyss, but I also understand that it's absolutely nothing like. I would never say that's equivalent to actually losing a child. He was in special care for 6 weeks, and the first week or so was you know, they didn't know if he was going to make it. So that was
a different kind of grief.
Yeah, he hadn't learned to breathe and all of that, you know, all that stuff.
So scary.
So that was, I thought I might have to deal with it, but then we were, luckily our story, unlike many people's, had a happy ending. So there was that. So I had a little taster.
Can I give you a pause? So I would say that was a living loss. So it isn't a loss from death, from grief, but it's a loss from what you were expecting. And it's a loss of the picture of the birth that you dreamed of the moment you learned that you were pregnant. You expected to give birth to a healthy child at the time with everyone there and the smiles and warmth. And actually you gave birth to a lot of complexity, trauma, fear, and the risk that he could die. And that is a living loss. And actually looking at your face, I can see that the fear of that and the sadness of that is still in you.
Yeah, it wasn't a good laugh. It wasn't a great laugh, to be honest with you. No, it was the worst thing that's ever happened to me, and it was awful. But as I say, it was all right. But you know, rather than turn this into an actual free therapy session for me, but I do want to say, I do think about grief and loss, because it's coming for me, right? I'm very close to my parents. They're in their 70s, and the reality is that one day they're going to go. Is there anything that we can do to prepare ourselves for that kind of reality?
Lots of things that you can do. I mean, one of the things that you can do is, first of all, letting yourself know it, that, you know, they're in their 70s, they're more likely to die sooner, and have conversations with them. Talk to them about the things that you may never have talked to them about. Tell them how much you love them. Ask them, do they want to be on a life support machine, or would they rather die without? Do they want to be buried or cremated? What are their passwords? How do they want to be remembered? I think one of the things that's much more important, really, than our our will of our goods and chattels is our ethical will. Like, if they wanted to pass something down to you and your family, what is it that they want? The values, the beliefs, what do they want you to remember? What really matters to them?
That's...
And do they fear death? Do they believe in God? What are their worries about? So when I work with a family, one of my kind of overarching questions is, what are your worries? And if you're like my mum, you'd say, nothing, and just change the subject. But somebody else who's more prepared to look at maybe their own death, they would say, I'm not frightened of being dead, I'm frightened of dying, or I don't want to die like my mum, I saw her die and she suffered, or so it'll bring stuff out. And then because the time you have now and when they die is that window you have an opportunity, and what you don't want is the regrets of after they've died of all the things you wished you'd said or done.
And we're in a privileged position because often you see when people do a post on Facebook about losing a parent or a really close person, that always put, tell everyone that you love, that you love them. Yeah, and there's that thing is that, did I tell them enough? You know, did they know how much they loved? I'm about to go home to Australia in April.
You must have missed them so much.
Yeah, I did actually, and I do. And so when I was in Australia 2 years ago, I was married.
Wow.
And then I came back, and a couple of months later, you know, I found out my husband had an affair, and then lockdown happened, and then...
Shit.
So I haven't seen my parents since I've changed in many, many, many ways. And my dad's 86 and my mum's going to be 80, and then, and they're both not that particularly well. So I'm very conscious that it might be the last, it could possibly be the last time I see them, because I only see them every couple of years.
That's a huge thing, isn't it? That that's when the miles really, really make a difference.
Yeah, and I've just been thinking about that a lot in the last couple of months in the lead up to seeing them, going... What do I really want to say to them? What experiences do I want? And I was thinking, I want to go and sit on the beach with my mum in the place that we sat when I was little and things like that. And I keep thinking, I don't want to overforce it. I don't want to go, look, you're nearly going. Come on, let's go and have some cake in our favourite cafe. You know, because I don't want to force those experiences, but I still want to make them, you know, that's, yeah.
But the thing that I imagine, it's not like they haven't had those thoughts.
Okay. What do you mean it's not all about me?
No, but it's not like they're not good. They're not thinking, well, maybe this could be the last time we see her.
Yeah.
So by you bringing it up and then going with which whatever they do, you may be actually liberating them to want to have these conversations. This whole thing of, I don't want to upset my mum or my dad or my daughter or my husband is actually the route normally to upset them. Because all the things you don't say and the conversations you don't have haunt you.
Mm.
And can I add a segue, which is, I don't like the term losing, lost, gone, passed away.
Yeah.
I like the word dead.
Excellent.
Dying.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You didn't, no one lost their mum and dad.
No.
Unless they left them in the park and they had a house.
No, I didn't. I did, so actually,
she did actually lose them.
Yeah. So,
tell her.
But that is a different thing, just to say.
Yes, exactly. So a few years ago, my parents were driving in the outback and they got lost for 24 hours.
Oh my God, like all those stories in Australia. Yeah.
So there were like 6 helicopters, the entire state. It was all over the news. Their mugshots, which were their photo IDs from their driving license, which made them look like criminals anyway, in the newspapers.
That's
and so,
so awful.
I thought they were dead.
Yes.
And I was booking flights, choosing hymns, you know, like just, I went into full, I've lost both my parents. And then I kept saying, what was the last thing I said to my father? What would I do?
So you know,
take a map.
Yeah. So go back to that video and use that video as the data to work on for when you see them.
Yeah.
Because that is giving you everything that you want to have done.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing I would do is record their voice and take tons of photos.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I thought I'll take my mic and have, even just think of 5 questions or, you know, things like that. That
ask them about their childhoods.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that.
Because I've got all the gear, and so it would be nice. I mean, it's kind of my job interviewing people, so it'd be nice to do it with
and
mom
most
and dad.
People really like talking about their past.
Yeah.
They really love remembering what it was like, and you know, I do that with my grandchildren. They look at me like a time without a telephone.
Was it in black and white, Granny?
Time that you could smoke in a cinema or on the aeroplane or in the tube.
Yeah, lovely. He came out smelling of smoke when he just went out for dinner. Yeah, that's great. Well, I think that's really lovely, because I think, you know, we're all entering this age where we may have all lost one parent, or they will die. Sorry. I have lost, that was correct, but we will see the death of our parents. And and I think it is this time of our lives, in our 40s and 50s, where we have to confront that. So yeah, and we're very good, both Australians and British people, of not dealing with it particularly well. And how do you think it's changing? Are you seeing how we deal with grief changing?
I do think it's really is changing. I mean, it's slow, like all change, always change takes a long time. I think the pandemic has sped it up in that when everyone thought other people were vectors of illness and disease and they felt everyone was going to die, I think there were more conversations around the kitchen table about death and dying than there had been for decades.
Mm.
But I think the kind of history of grief comes from kind of the First World War. So Queen Victoria was the poster woman for grief. You know, she wore black after Albert died. It was fashionable to wear black, and you had your black memorabilia. So you talked about death, but you never talked about sex. So sex didn't happen.
Ah, interesting.
You know, don't look at your down belows. But then that's what my
mother... Helen only looked at hers for the first time last year. She's 42.
Yeah.
That's what my mum called them, down belows. Anyway.
I like it. I'm going to check. My other favourite one that we had some of the podcasts called it a panini, but I'm going to change it to down belows.
Yeah.
That's going in the book.
And then the First World War happened, where millions of people died and were not buried. And that, you know, there were so many, everybody had someone who died, whether it was a husband, a father, or a child. And then there was the flu epidemic of 1918, where more millions died. And so no one could afford to grieve, because no one was able to listen, and everyone was suffering. And so they had to go into overdrive of survive and get on. So shut down the pain, multiply, don't talk about sex, have lots of sex, have lots of children.
get
on with it. Try and build life back, because that is your imperative to survive. Nobody cares what you feel about from an evolutionary perspective. It's just to keep going. And then the Second World War came, which my parents fought in, who were children of survivors of the First World War. So they didn't talk about death either. And really, it's only since we've had these 60, 70 years of actual not having war in the country and not being under threat and lots of psychological knowledge that we didn't have. My parents didn't have a clue. I mean, not a clue. I mean, I think my dad wouldn't have known what a feeling... What I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They just didn't have that language. And so now we have a great deal more knowledge and emotional intelligence and on which we can dare to express how we feel and grieve.
So I have another practical question.
Okay, I'm good at practical.
Which is, you know, we talked about maybe preparing for our parents' death. Is there any ways to prepare for our own death? Because I'm like 44 now, and I read this book, which I've probably banged on about on here before, called 4,000 Weeks.
Oh, yes.
About how the average lifespan is about 4,000 weeks, right? And that's if you live to be 90. And then I was like, oh, right, but then that means I'm like halfway through. So that means I've only got 2,000 weeks. And that doesn't... I mean, I've got a lot of Married at First Sight Australia still to get through. That doesn't feel like a very long time. So I do... I find it really comforting, though. I find that like, oh, cool, all right, I'm conscious of how long I've got, so I'm not going to waste it. And I find that quite motivating. But I do think about death and think, God, you know, how can we prepare ourselves? And what do we do when we get this feeling like, is it coming? You know, am I wasting time? How do you deal with that?
I mean, I think lots of things about that. I think when we deny our death, and, you know, a lot of our culture is, you know, close my eyes, pretend it happens to other people and push it out the door. And then when it does happen, when you get a health diagnosis or someone you love dies, you don't have any of the tools or the wherewithal or the kind of information to deal with it. So the first step is the awareness of it, which can change your perception of what matters and help you prioritise in a really positive way. And also it can give you perspective. So if you're losing it because something hasn't been delivered, you kind of can use the perspective of, well, I'm healthy and I'm well. Mm. And, you know, nobody died. And so maybe losing my shit...
And when I'm dead, no one will care. Yeah.
Losing my shit with a delivery driver is probably... You know, it can help you improve. But also, I think, the psychological perspective that I think is helpful is that what we don't face, we can't... I kind of either fix or learn to integrate. So that the more you have conversations with yourself or journal or talk to your husband or talk to each other or your best friends about death and dying, then it has less fear. It's silence that contaminates and sends fear through our bodies. But the thing I do, like with my kids, and they're like, Mom, you know, I send them my passwords. I send them all of my passwords. Mm. I've told them that I want to be cremated. I told them where I want my ashes to be scattered. But just because I think it's useful information. Mm. And I have it in a little thing in my desk in my drawer. And I photographed it and sent it to my four kids. And they were like, they gave me kind of emojis like, mm.
I think that's so good, though. And
but the torture people have when they don't know the passwords.
Absolutely.
Their father's
maddening.
Died. And they have his life on his computer.
Yeah.
It's just awful.
Well, in some cases, maybe it's good not to be able to access your father's hard drive, but that's perhaps a story for another time. But my husband, for example, sometimes a bloody nightmare, Julia. My husband, Pete, he wants a Viking funeral. I'm like, oh, that'll be easy to arrange in southeast London. I'll just get a bloody longboat, will I, and pour a load of petrol and push it down Lewisham Canal. Nobody's going to bat an eyelid. Like,
but
I
he just wants you to have to really do a lot of work. Right?
He'll get what he's given. He'll get what he's given. Don't believe in an afterlife, so he can't haunt me. Tough luck. That's it.
That's so funny.
Why does he want a Viking one?
You know, it's attention. He's still. It's just a.
He wants to.
I think he sees himself as some sort of Nordic warrior, when in actual fact, you know, he's an IT professional from South London. So I don't, you know, who knows what goes on in that man's head. In fact, I might send him to see you. You can dig it out.
I was going to actually move on to your book, because we're, you know, a lot of the discussion we've had so far is about family, isn't it? It's about moments in our life where things don't go how we planned. Like, Ellie had a premature baby, my parents got lost, and then my husband turned out to be a terrible man. So, and that...
She says, laughing, I mean, yeah. If you were my client, I would do something with that.
She's off again. No, we're both stroking our chins.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think that's it. And as you were saying about having the silence and the uncomfortable conversations, because we don't want crap things to happen in our lives. We don't, but it just happens. And it's about what are the building blocks or what are the strategies that we can cope to talk about these things, because it doesn't go away. And my mum's catchphrase was just forgive and forget, forgive and forget. I'm like, really? You really forgiven that person? And have you really forgotten? But that was her sort of...
Her mantra.
Yes, that was the wave, you know, the magic wand.
Did it work for her?
I don't think it did.
Do you think there's just piles of unforgiven resentment?
I think there's the lasagna. All sorts of memories and things. And I really appreciated reading your book. We were lucky enough to get an advanced copy.
Because you're so important.
Yes. That's what we told the publishers. Please send us very advanced copies about you during the pandemic having these conversations on Zoom, and how finally it was so much easier to bring everybody together, because otherwise it was like logistically times and trying to get. And so I'd love you to talk about those conversations or what it's like being a family therapist, because what a privilege it is to look into somebody's, it's like peering in the window of someone's home.
It was incredible. I mean, my basis is that every client that's ever walked through my door has always spent a huge amount of their time talking about their family of origin or the family they're trying to make. That it's a big part, and yet all the people involved aren't present. And people who come into therapy become because they're suffering in the present, But actually, after, you know, maybe even 20 minutes, you can see that it's woven with threads from the past, from the things their mothers have said, experiences with their dad, the rivalry with their siblings, or the sibling rivalry of their childhood they're taking into their marriage, you know. So there's always those things. And so I thought, I really want to examine it with everybody in the room so that I can hear everyone's voice, with the idea that often there's this black and white thing of my version is right and you're wrong, but we can expand our level of connection and good intention in families where we allow everyone's view to be heard. And that, you know, I only saw, so I did 8 case studies, very different families. So I did, you know, a kind of middle class family with a grandmother and the mother and the daughter getting to university. I did Orthodox Jewish family, 5 generations, where the great grandmother was an ultra Orthodox Jew who'd been in Auschwitz and survived.
Extraordinary.
I did a family that had been in great poverty and separated, and there was a lot of difficulty in the relationship. A lot of it caused by the poverty, actually, truth be told. And a Black Afro-Caribbean family where a child had died. So lots of different stories with different backgrounds. And I only saw all of them for probably 6, 8, or 10 sessions, which is basically a series of Netflix.
Yeah.
But what I learned from each of them on the screen was that the thing that matters is the level of how we can be honest with each other and trust each other and allow each other to be themselves, allow the difference. So rather than, you know, forget and move on, like your mum says, you know, where you love most, you also hate most. You have the biggest fights because you care most. And so indifference is the opposite of love, not hate. But in families, you need to learn how to fight productively, how to kind of have a fight, go off, storm off, but then come back and repair. So in the trade, it's called rupture and repair. So you properly repair and you have a conversation after the fight to kind of work out what was going on. And what I kind of loved from it was that it, they felt like, you know, I was in the room with them and they were in the room with me. And these people who had known each other literally all their lives discovered aspects of themselves that they never knew existed. And that they did all feel closer in the end. And there was a family whose father had died by suicide 40 years before the Rossi family. And the children had been, you know, very young, a 3-year-old up to a 9-year-old. And the thing that I saw with the Holocaust and the suicide family was, until you deal with the pain from the past, it keeps playing out and injuring the present. The unresolved trauma from the past fucks with your life until someone's prepared to feel the pain. And so one of the big messages from the book, from sort of transgenerational trauma, but also ways of coping with trauma, is once you deal with the pain and allow yourself to express it, then you can be released from it and learn to engage with life and trust again.
So going, just going back to what you were saying about fighting, so fighting is all right. Is that what we're saying? Which I find like, that's quite a relief to hear.
It's unavoidable.
Yeah.
How is it not?
Well, yeah, I had a friend I remember saying, he said to me that me and my husband like fight a lot, and him and his girlfriend
never fight.
And I was like, cool, good for you. Then they got married and then they had children, and things have changed a little bit.
Isn't that funny?
Which strange feels slightly snug. Yeah. But there's a right way and a wrong way to fight.
There is a right way and a wrong way. So, I mean, I think one of the wrong ways to fight is to use words of weapons of mass destruction and really kind of slay them, and also bring up that laundry list of all the stuff that they've done in the past. You always da 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 da. So if you can fight in a way that you're actually naming what you feel, like when you didn't take the fucking bins out, I felt...
I find that so hard, though, because sometimes it looks like you're mental because you're going batshit because they haven't taken the bins out or whatever. But I feel I need to explain, no, it's not just
the bins
today and these bins. It's also the dishwasher. It's also you were late to do the thing the other week. It's also you still haven't done the car insurance. It's 100 things. But so, whereas if I'm just standing there shouting about bins, I feel like a mad person. I feel like I need to explain.
But that's fine. So, if the bin represents all this stuff that's piled up that's in the present, that is fine. What I'm talking about is then 3 years ago, you, because you've never resolved it, you've never sorted it out. And that, you know, he can say that you're being difficult and demanding and, you know, he's done all this other stuff. And then you have to kind of go away, lower the heat, and then come back and look at practically what is going on. What does the bins represent? How do you find a way, which never happens, of sharing the load? It never does. All the research shows it.
Well, it's just women doing.
I think it is possible, but there's something that's not happening.
Right.
I've never seen it happen, have you? Invisible labour, women do much more.
Yeah, and the mental load we've talked about many, many times.
The emotional load.
Yeah, and just the expectation that you will buy the birthday presents, you will buy the, you know, Christmas present for his mother, all those sort of things. You're like, I'm carrying everything all the time. And then when you do snap, you're like, where has all this rage come from? But it's that, yeah, it's all the little paper cuts that kind of build up. And getting angry is something that I had to learn to do in the last couple of years, for obvious reasons.
So you never used to get angry?
I did. We did have fights, but I would smooth it over. I felt that I was very much the peacemaker. And
like your mum?
Yeah, exactly. She, yes, very much smoothing over. And because I didn't want conflict and I wanted to be married. I wanted to be a wife. I wanted her to be happy. And I worked really hard at it, and we did lots of couples therapy as well.
Did you?
Yeah, twice. So, you know,
well,
it was a graft.
Really bloody worked, didn't
Jesus,
it?
I know. Did you want a refund, thanks?
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Might have helped if he'd said during the therapy what he was actually doing outside of the therapy, Julie. Yeah. I suspect you can't really blame the therapist if the man's not really playing the game.
No, exactly. He's fucking lying the whole time.
He's fucking someone else, aren't he?
Anyways, as she laughs again,
yes.
Please make some notes, Julia, for later. But yeah, I think that it's really... What was my train of thought? What was I trying to say?
About fighting.
Go back. Yeah,
yes, fighting.
See, I'm a therapist, I remember things. I log them.
About, because I would say Ellie's much better at fighting or bringing things up that I suppress. But I think I've learnt that from my mother, is that it just gets suppressed. But then when I used to see her when everything got too much, I was completely petrified. I was like, oh, she's a different lady, when it could have sort of bobbled along. So I think that's what I'm sort of, and when I do get angry with my children, I explain it. I don't just try and explain it. I'm like, listen, you know, I'm feeling really angry because of this, that and the other thing. How do we improve that for next time, instead of just having those occasional explosions as well?
And that is, then they trust you. Because children don't know what's going on, and they normally make it up that they've done something wrong. Or, you know, I think the worst, one of the most difficult things is when you don't know which parent you're going to get. Are you going to get the mum that's really, really nice and calm, or this explosive, terrifying mum, and you don't know what you've done or why it's happened. But when you can explain, I'm really upset, you know, partly because Dad's gone.
Yeah.
Because I'm worried about my mum and Dad, and that means that I blow up much more often. And then afterwards you can give them a cuddle and they can say they're really cross with you. I hate it, Mum. You know, grandchildren tell their parents, I hate it when you're bossy with me. I hate it when... Actually, I can't talk about my own grandchildren. It's not fair, my children.
No, that's one of them's awful.
No, my children and grandchildren are amazing. But they're my grandchildren are much... They're very good at saying what they want.
Yeah. It's really
great.
It's really impressive. Empowering. And my children talk about their feelings all day long. And I think that's one of the gifts of divorce in a way, because we have to talk about big feelings all the time, because their feelings are going up and down, and you know, and they've got a small form of grief.
They do. It's a living loss.
Yeah. And so I think that's been the gift. And also, for me, going through a trauma gave me the gift of much deeper friendships, because I was like, this is really shit and I don't know what I'm doing. And then other friends would start opening up, and that brought me so much closer to my girlfriends, which I thought, oh wow, these are the you know, it's a bit like the flowers that come after the bushfire.
Yeah. I mean, that's really true, that you build really close friendships and love by being honest with each other and trading stories of your vulnerability and your suffering, not your suffering, but you know, the things that bother you. Not, and you, I think it's virtually impossible. Maybe I'm the therapist, so this is me. But, you know, always putting on a show, everything's chirpy, you know, everything's lovely. How does that build a really great friendship? I'm not sure how.
And it's knackering as well.
It's knackering.
Going back to the family thing, another personal question.
Yeah.
Should you make kids say sorry? This is around my husband and I. We have an ongoing disagreement about this. I'm a big believer in saying sorry. Me and my husband once had a fight where he said, anyway, in 10 minutes you'll be over it and you'll say sorry anyway. You're always the first one to say sorry.
What an idiot.
Which, you can imagine how well that went in terms of ending the fight.
That. Yes. Yeah.
So, and then, of course, I found it really difficult to say sorry after that first.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
you know,
he blew himself up.
Yeah, and I said, go fuck yourself in your Viking funeral. That's what I said. But yes, but when kids have done a bad thing, when they've hit their brother or they've broken the thing, whatever, not an accident, I mean a deliberate bad thing, he's like, you have to make them say sorry, because that's what we have to do as humans. That's what we do to each other. That's polite, but it's also morally correct. And I'm like, that's true, but equally just making them say, and you know when they go, sorry. And I'm like, have they actually learned anything from that other than an authority figure has the power to make them do a thing that they don't feel like doing and they don't mean and it isn't authentic? So am I right, Julia? That's what I'm saying.
I don't know.
Oh, God.
I genuinely don't know. I think both sort of have a logic, don't they? All make sense. I mean, the thing I did was make my children say sorry. But I don't know if I was right. I made tons of mistakes. Maybe that was one of them.
Well, do they say sorry now?
They do. Then they do all say sorry. They're good at saying sorry.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether that's because they're decent human beings, despite my parenting, or because I forced them and shouted at them to say sorry when they were little.
My theory is saying sorry, and I say sorry a lot in front to them and to Pete, I'm hoping eventually they'll just go, oh, right, that's what you do. I'll copy that.
Mm.
But what if they grow up thinking I'm a twat? And then they go,
they're
going to
do that anyway.
Doing that. Do the opposite. Yeah, they're going to do that anyway.
You've stolen the answer I actually had thought of, which is that children learn from what you do, not from what you say.
Mm.
So they, when they observe you, how you fight, how you repair after a fight, saying a short sorry and then a genuine sorry with a hug the next day or, you know, a few hours later, that's how they learn, is by observing the adults around them.
Great. Right, I'm going to get home and talk to Pete. But
ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
No, that's really true. And I think I'm really conscious now of my children having happy, healthy relationships. And, you know, occasionally Hugo just spontaneously says...
My twin brother's called Hugo.
It's an excellent name.
It's a very
good name. We were just walking to the supermarket one day and he said, Mummy, when I'm older, if I'm in a relationship, if things go bad, I think I'll just talk about it, and then if we're not happy, we'll break up. And I was like, that's a really good idea, Hugo. But I could tell that he was sort of, he's processing what good relationships are. And I know when he has tricky relationships at school, he's like, oh, I don't want to be mean to someone. And I think he's processing, you know, all the things that he's going through, and the divorce and how it happened and things like that. And that's, I find that really reassuring, because I have that fear. I was like, oh gosh, you know. And when I've talked to other people about, you know, when you're the child of someone who's cheated, you have that fear that you might do it, or it might happen to you. So it's sort of, it's been good to sort of have these sort of chats about it, because I did, you don't want it to sort of build up in the silence, because I know so many friends, and especially when I was writing the book about the divorce, they said it was people not talking about it that was the hardest thing. Everyone thought it was the best thing for kids. Oh, well, you know, you now go to dad's every second weekend, but that's just the rules, and no one's going to talk about it.
And I think that is a you know, it's great that you wrote it in your book, and it's a key message of my book, is that what you don't say gets passed down and imagined in the next generation, and then is much more likely to be acted out.
Mm.
Whereas if you can have the conversations and face the difficulties and ask the difficult questions, and not necessarily being given answers, but allowed to kind of talk about them without answers, then you have much more agency and sense of yourself of how you can deal with them. You know, having this deep, unprocessed fear that I'm going to be like my dad is much more haunting and much more likely to happen.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess it was funny doing I do weekly therapy now, and have had couples therapy, and I kept thinking, I am my mother, and just trying to distinguish myself. And you hear the phrases, you know, oh, we've had a lovely day, don't ruin it now, you know, all that sort of things. You're just tired, things like that, which is kind of sweet. But then you think, oh, you have to process. And becoming, I don't know what it was like for you, Ellie, becoming a mother changed quite drastically my relationship with my own mum.
In a good way.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, why did you have five children? It's very, very, very tiring. And I just had two. You had four, didn't you? Is that right?
I had four and I'm one of five.
Yeah.
So my mum had two sets of twins.
Blimey.
My father said she always overdid it, your mum.
Show off.
But, I mean, one of the other messages in my book, I think, is the unrecognised importance of grandparents. The power of grandparents, of how they've influenced their own children, but also the wonderful relationship of the grandchild to the grandparent, which doesn't have the stresses and the daily wear and tear of parenting, but is much more liberating. There was a mum in the Thompsons where the grandchild was going home, and the grandchild, going to university rather, and she chose to go and stay with her grandmother rather than her parents, because it was during lockdown, her parents having quite a lot of fights about COVID and, you know, all the rules and stuff. And actually her daughter, if that had happened to me, I'd have been quite jealous and minded, like, you're rejecting me. But actually her daughter had adored her grandmother too. And so there was something about having another woman in your life that you really love, that isn't your mum, that you can go to and have fun with in a completely different way, that I didn't really have very active. Well, three of my grandparents were dead by the time I was born, so they weren't active at all.
Sort of the opposite of active, yeah, one could say.
And then the other grandmother, I saw for Sunday lunch, you know, not, she wasn't very active. And it's a whole new discovery to me how amazing grandparents can be. You must miss that.
Yeah, I do. But they've had more time with their grandparents than I did, even though my granny lived, you know, 2 hours drive away, because we'd see her every couple of months, but it would be for lunch. But now my mum comes out to Australia from Australia and she's here for 3 weeks. And I think, God, they have a much richer...
Isn't that lovely?
...longer time than I ever had with my... Like, I think I saw my maternal grandmother about 6 times in my life. Wow. Because she lived in Queensland. And so you could only see her every couple of years anyway. And when we did,
it was not there.
No, it wasn't there at all. So I love the relationship. And, like, we do FaceTime and all that sort of stuff. So there, even though it's not close physically, I feel like there's a really lovely connection.
Think FaceTime and social, and all of the online stuff has enabled families to be close at a time when we haven't been able to. It's the only thing that saved us, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
What about when things go badly wrong? Like, is there ever a point where we do need to cut out a family member or kind of go, I can't engage with you anymore? How do we know when that moment's there? And is it always repairable, reparable? Is it, there are some relationships you just have to go, that is broken and that's done?
I mean, none of these questions have black and white answers. Mm. But, you know, in the book, there's the guy, Archie Craig, and he had a brain tumour and came from a very dysfunctional family. But he really did love and care for his mum and dad. But she was impossible once he was dying because she just made it all about her. So he had to cut off her. But I think my message would be, it's nothing's for free. You know, you can cut off your parents and you can kind of hope that keeps a lot of the distress and the difficulty at bay. But you will always have a feeling, because they're always part of you, your family. They're kind of in embedded in you.
Like a verruca.
Well, like HPV.
Mm. Oh, God. Only you two. That's where your minds went.
Yeah. There's a point in that, yeah.
But, so, I mean, I think sometimes you do have to choose for your mental health to cut them off.
Hmm.
But I think it's always painful.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's it. Like, you can, it's not out of sight, out of mind.
No, that's the right thing to say.
And when you're processing, like obviously I am with divorce, I kind of think, oh yeah, I'm really good. I've been really good for about 3 months. You know, I'm really great. And then, someone will ask you a question or something will just happen. Like this morning I was being interviewed on a siblings podcast and they said, oh, did your brother John help, or how did he help during your divorce? And I literally burst into tears. I said, oh, he was the first person I saw the day after I found out about my husband. And I talk about divorce all day long. I've written a book about it and I talk about getting angry, and it was talking about the kindness, and then I just cried and cried. Yeah. I was like, why am I crying about someone caring about me, because I'm still hurting? So it was really interesting. I was like, yeah, but I'm writing articles and make jokes about divorce, and you know, I'm in the show, we talk about I love dating and I'm free and all that sort of stuff, but I'm not completely free. There is that sort of rock, or that, you know, that thing. And I found it really interesting, because I know I spoke to my therapist directly afterwards, and it was really good actually to kind of confront that, because I just thought, oh no. And people want to know. They keep writing to me every day going, how long does it take? How long does it take to feel better? When do you know? When do you tick all the boxes off? And it was like, I don't know.
I mean, but so this is another living loss, right? So yeah, it's a grief from the loss of what you committed to, and you wanted to be married and wanted to be a wife and wanted to have the family, and you hoped it was going to be forever. So you're grieving all of the dreams that you hoped and kind of assumed that you'd have.
Yeah.
And I think it's really, both I feel very tender towards you hearing you talk about your brother John, because you, when you're talking about John, you're not defended, because he loved you and he got you in your heart. So then you open your heart, and that's when you can kind of express it.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, it's like you can put on your armour and talk about it.
Yeah.
But with grief, often people who I see who are divorcing, they say, I wish he was dead, because it would be so much simpler.
Yes.
I'm not sure it would be simpler, truth be told.
Because your children,
your children would be without their dad.
Yeah, no.
And that's quite bad.
Yeah.
And that's very bad.
It's okay. We're not implying that at all.
No. But
we don't literally wish him dead, just to be clear. Let's clarify that now. Exactly. For any legal proceedings that may ensue in the next few years.
But the thing about grief when you've loved someone and you're still loving them when they die is that you feel the pain of their loss, and the love never dies, so that you can go on loving them after death by touchstones to memory. The difficulty with you is that you did love him. There's probably elements of that love that you don't want to let yourself know of. Mm. And there were times that you had and the children that you shared. And so, but you don't want to go to those, the positive places, because you hate the fucker.
Yeah.
So it's very complicated, is yeah. what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so when people say to you, when are you over it? My answer is always, it gets much less intense.
Mm.
But as human beings, we're not machines. And you don't switch off, and you don't switch on, and you don't switch off. And there isn't such a thing as closure. You do learn to live with things, and you accommodate. But out of the blue, 20 years down the line, you can suddenly get hit by a feeling. And you think, fuck, I thought I'd dealt with that.
I've drawn a line through that one. I've ticked that
and
box.
And we don't, because we're ignited by sight, sound, touch and smell. And you can just have a smell of a meal that you had with your husband that was a very happy meal, or a glass of wine or something.
Or perhaps you step in some dog shit in the street, something like that. And that just brings up a memory.
I am being sincere.
Light and shade, Julia, light and shade.
Sorry, Julia.
That's all right.
You were saying, it brings up a memory, you can have a meal.
And then it will, you'll be in tears and you'll think, I'm over it.
Yeah.
And we do. We learn to live with things. And we have a superpower as human beings. We have this capacity, neuroplasticity, to adapt and change, so that you grow and thrive through adversity and you get bigger and you get stronger. But that doesn't mean that you don't feel stuff.
Yeah. No, I think that's very, very, very
true.
So
it's not about getting over something, it's about becoming engorged by it.
No, it's not!
I like that image. All right, maybe I'm putting words into that. You wrote your next book, then that'll be in there. You wait and see.
Yeah.
So your book is called?
Every Family Has a Story, How We Inherit Love and Loss.
Excellent. And who would you say the book's for? Is it for people who've lost... Or is it just people in a family, or
anyone who has a family, which is everyone?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that all the people that have read it have said to me they see aspects of themselves, even though they come from very different families.
Mm.
And I think what I hope people will get is that there's no such thing as a perfect family, that we all kind of move on a spectrum of functional, dysfunctional, and to kind of forgive yourselves and kind of know that you're doing the best you can. And then I have these 12 touchstones to family, which kind of support you at the end. But also stories, I think stories are so powerful. Mm. True stories, these are all true stories.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And that's what people want to connect with. And also, we're nosy.
And we're nosy.
Bloody nosy.
Yeah.
We want to know what's going wrong.
Yes. You should be a therapist.
Maybe I will. How long does it take?
About 5 years.
Right, okay.
Not full time.
Hang on, I've got to check how many weeks I've got left again then.
Yeah.
Think
exactly.
About that one.
Exactly. Oh. Did you love that book? I shouldn't be plugging somebody else.
I thought you meant your book for a minute. I was like, that's a very personal question, Julie. Of course I did. Yes, no. I did. I thought it was great. Did you like it?
Yeah, I think it was very good.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant. It's definitely, it has made me realise, but for me, it's not just about going, oh, these are the things I want to do, like I want to go on that holiday or I want to go to that restaurant. It's not just that. It's like, actually, these are the things I don't want to do. I've only got 2,000 weeks. I don't want to spend them all doing shit that I'm not interested in.
Do you have a better
name? That makes me tired or,
or see people that you don't really care about.
Yeah.
It's a waste of my life.
Enough about me. Now it is time for the Scummy Mummy Confessions. Now.
I've got one, actually.
Oh, go for it.
I have to confess, I still smoke. I'm trying to quit, sort of. Anyway, so my kids get very cross.
Right? I get very cross as
she
well,
gets
Julia.
Very cross.
Everyone should get cross.
Yeah, I know.
I'm cross.
It's 2,000 weeks and you're making it 53 at
this
rate.
Okay, anyway. It's because...
It's because now we've got therapists here. It's because why?
It harks back to me being young, and there's some frivolousness about it. And I love staying up late smoking with my
family. Makes you feel naughty and cool.
Yeah, fucking yes, it does.
How naughty and cool are you going to be when you're dead of lung cancer? Sorry, Julia,
emphysema.
You go. And you've got emphysema.
All right. So this is a good point. Anyway, so I've decided I'm going to run the London Marathon again.
Well, fucking hell, stop smoking.
All right. Okay. goodness
this
me.
Is what we came for.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so I said to the kids in a sort of grand gesture, I said, you wanted me to stop smoking, I will. I've decided to run the London Marathon and that will inspire me to stop smoking. And my daughter crossed her arms and said, yeah, right. I'll see it, you know, like, I'll believe it when I see it. And I was like, oh, so yeah, my children are very sensible. So my Scummy Mummy confession is that I'm just still smoking with my children. If they find cigarettes in my bag, they'll come up to me and they'll snap them in half and
good.
Put them in the bin and go,
good,
stop doing that, Mummy. I was like,
good.
Quite so, right.
Yeah, let your children influence you.
Yeah. And they were like, we don't want, why would you do something that makes you sick and makes you unhealthy? And I was like, yeah, all right. I'm feeling deep feelings now, people.
Shame. What do you do, Julia, when someone you care about won't fucking listen to you and you're just trying to save their life and be a good friend? How do you cope with that?
Punch them. In the face. permission granted. Okay. That's good. My best
what
therapy
date?
Answer.
Let's set a date now while we're here. What date are you going to give up?
Can it be after I come back from Australia? Can I just have a few faggy nights?
I would accept that. What do you think, Julia?
With my friends.
You're the professional.
Okay, so
let's go with Julia.
Let's do a deal.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't give up when you come back from Australia,
yes.
What is the punishment?
Ooh.
I've got one.
What is it?
No sex for 6 months.
Oh, God, no!
Ooh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
If you don't stop putting things in your mouth, you can't put things down there in your down
below. In your down below.
Right. Oh, I don't want to give up sex. I love sex. Okay.
So are we going to say you're going to have your last cigarette in Australia?
Yes, I think so. With
that's
that baggy.
Have hypnotherapy or something.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Do stuff that helps you.
Acupuncture.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
I started smoking when I was 7.
Oh, Julia.
Yes.
How did you get hold of those?
I stole my mum's cigarettes. Her Rothmans.
Oh, gosh. But this was of the time. That was very...
And then I was caught by my dad, who looked out the window and saw me in my little school uniform.
Sorry.
Poddling down the garden, hiding in the garden shed, smoking a cigarette. So I had to come home and write 100 lines. I promise I'll never smoke again. And I went on smoking. I hid and smoked in Holland Park behind the Holland Park sign every day before I went to school. And I only really stopped smoking when I got pregnant with my first child.
Wow. Well, there you go. You pair of smokers. Look at the state of
you. I still dream sometimes that I've started smoking again. And I wake up and I think, oh, shit, have I? No, I haven't.
Yeah. I'm very excited now. I can't tell you. We've got a date.
Okay, and you report to me.
Yes,
if she's smoking.
Right. Accountability.
I'll send you
and
pictures.
Then I'll bring my kickboxing gloves
and
punch her in her kickboxing class if she hasn't stopped smoking. Is that the deal?
Deal.
And remove all her dildos, all her sex kits.
Oh, my God.
All her everything stuff.
God, I'm
no wanking out off the
no
phone.
No wanking. We're going full banana.
I have to go to bed in my boxing gloves.
She can wank. It's
okay.
Just not,
thank
not
God
with
for
anybody
that.
Else.
No.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
She can have solo sex, but nothing with another body.
It's not the same. You know I like an Italian after dinner. Anyway.
Better stop smoking then.
All right then.
Excellent. I feel like we've achieved so much. Julia, do you have a scummy mummy?
Thank you.
Yes, we're not paying for this. Julia, do you have a scummy mummy confession that you could share with us?
Well, so it goes with the exercise thing.
Mm.
So my children are very nice to me on the whole, but give me a lot of teasing and shit, obviously. And one of the ones was, I used to pick them up from school, apparently, I actually do remember this though, so it isn't really apparently, in a bright pink thong with leopard skin leggings.
Awesome.
After I'd been to the gym, and then pick them up from school in my pink thong and let them see, and embarrass them in front of all
awesome.
Of
their friends. Julia, smoking like a chimney, Rothmans on the go.
Oh,
wow.
That's embarrassing.
I think that sounds quite cool.
I reckon that's really cool.
That is not cool. No. Not your mum.
Have you always kickboxed then?
Yeah.
Have you always done exercise?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I started when I got married.
Mm.
But I got married at 10, so.
Oh, I see.
Oh, well, you are a scummy mummy, would you agree, Julia Samuel?
I'm definitely a scummy mummy.
Well, we're very honoured to have had you on the podcast. Thank you very much for coming on and telling us about your excellent book, which is, when's it out?
March the 17th.
March 17th.
And your other books, Julia, are available now?
So Grief Works is stories of people grieving different deaths. And This Too Shall Pass, which is about life is change. And has a COVID study in it and stuff like that.
Brilliant.
And an app. I've got a grief app. So people are grieving. I'm the platform.
You've got an app. We haven't got an app. We should get an app.
I know. We
it's
need
a
more.
Good app. It's a 28-day course. Yeah. Oh, very, very good.
Fantastic.
Fucking app.
And you're on Instagram, I believe, Julia. What's your handle?
At Julia Samuel MBE.
Mm-hmm. At Julia Samuel MBE, I've got an app. That's just the bio. I've got an app. Love it, love it. We haven't got an app, but we've got an Instagram account.
We
at
do.
Scummy Mummies. We've got a shop at scummymummies.com.
Mm-hmm. What's not am I doing buying very well. At Scummy Mummies?
Oh, please buy something. Nobody's buying anything. We've got mugs that say wine mug on them, if you like that sort of thing.
That is funny.
We've got Mum Island towels. No one buys those. We've got a lot of T-shirts and hoodies that
say Scummy Mummy.
Scummy Mummy, or what else do they say?
Gin and on it.
Yeah.
Are we there yet?
Things maybe like the products aren't good enough yet.
It's a mum thing.
We're not selling it very well.
No, but the best...
You're not selling it well, to be honest.
The
way you said it is like...
Oh, just don't bother.
Don't
go there. The most exciting part of our job is, of course, our live shows, Ellie, and we're going here, there and everywhere. Taunton.
Nottingham.
Swindon.
Yes.
Tewkesbury. Trowbridge. We're going to the Sausage and Cider Festival in Derbyshire, everyone's favourite festival. We're going to the Retreat Festival in Wales. And
the day this goes out, we'll be in Leeds. We'll be doing Chesterfield the next day. Yes, Taunton we're going to. Swindon, you said Swindon. Newbury, did you say Horsham?
Wellingborough,
Portsmouth, Basingstoke,
Cambridge. That's right. And we're hopefully going to the Edinburgh Festival again this year.
Yes. So go to scummymummies.com. All the dates and the tickets and the, merchandise is on there.
The
merch is on there.
Yeah.
Is that everything?
I think so.
Is that all the admin?
What a joy. Thank you, Julia.
Are we high-fiving?
Yes.
Love it.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much, Julia. Thank you very much for having us.
Buy her book.
Thank you for listening. Buy her book. Buy her books. And stop smoking.
Yeah.
And that's today's life lessons.
All right.
Or no sex ever again.
Oh, come on.
Until next time.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
It's been lovely to have you. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for saving Helen's life.
I'm living a longer, much more fulfilled life now. And what
in
your other?
I can hear it in your breath.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Awful.
Terrible.
Awful.
Really should we bully her?
Yeah. Okay. That always works.
Yeah, that really works.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.